UK Wine Show, show number 61, Negotiants with Louis Latour. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 61 for the 27th of July, 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking about the role of negotiants. We talk with Louis Latour, owner of Maison Louis Latour, one of Burgundy's powerhouse negotiants. We talk with Louis about negotiants, how they work, and some of the issues facing Burgundy. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In the news this week, Carlsberg launch wine, and English wine scoops a French trophy. But first, news that UK drinkers may be getting more adventurous in their choice of wine. Figures just out from Wines of Spain show an increase in UK shipments of Albarino of 60%. The UK now accounts for a massive 40% of European sales of the grape. So while Spain has been overtaken by Chile in the UK league tables, their wines are still whetting the appetite of British consumers. Meanwhile, lager giant Carlsberg has launched a range of 15 wines from around the world. The range features key grape varieties from 8 Old World and New World countries, including a Spanish Tempranillo, an Italian Pinot Grigio, and a Chardonnay and Zinfandel from California. The new brand is called Invino, which means to discover in Latin, and will only be available behind the bar in the on-trade. The question is, will they live up to Carlsberg's high standards and claim if Carlsberg did wine, they'd probably be the best in the world? I'm sorry, but probably not. Finally, fantastic news for English wine producer Ridgeview. Their Merit Fitzrovia 2004 has collected the prize for Best International Sparkling Rosé in the French Le Mondial du Rosé competition. The wine was up against other sparkling wines, but not champagne, which has its own category. In international competitions, the categories do vary. The International Wine Challenge does have a trophy for champion sparkling wine, but it is only awarded in a year where there's an outstanding sparkler. Meanwhile, the International Wine and Spirit Competition used to bring champagne and sparkling wines together, but now keeps them as separate categories. Regardless, English sparklers are winning awards all over the place, and without doubt are world class. That's all for this week, but 120 years ago, it was Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee Week. Four publicans received a court summons from a group of teetotals who tried to prosecute them for staying open late for the special occasion. A magistrate dismissed the summons because the pubs opened knowing there was an order from the Home Secretary to the Metropolitan Police not to take action against those who stayed open until 2 in the morning. Don't forget you can get more detail on these news stories on the news homepage at our website www.3050.co.uk. That's it from me. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers for that, Jane. Good on Ridgeview for winning another award. But I'm interested this week in Spain being leapfrogged by Chile. It's quite interesting that Spain is one of the world's biggest producers of wine and is almost single-handedly the producer of the most common grape variety planted. No, we're not talking Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon. The world's biggest produced wine grape is Arion. Never heard of it? Well, you're lucky. It's a mass-produced wine in La Mancha and used predominantly for brandy. But Spain is one of Europe's best-kept wine secrets. With individual varieties and production methods, there's a good diversity of style from cool climates in the rather cool, wet north right through to arid conditions in central Spain. I was pleased to see that Albarino from Rias Baixas in the northwest coast just above Portugal is becoming popular in the UK. It's a cracking wine and a lot of people enjoy it. But there's some interesting wines from all over Spain. Rias Baixas is one of the trendy regions at the moment, and there's the more expensive Priorat on the northeast coast. Even well-known regions like Rioja are having hot competition from the likes of Ribera del Duero, just slightly south and west from Rioja. And while it seems that everybody is having a go growing grapes such as Tempranillo, the main grape behind Rioja, Spain has hundreds of unique grapes to try. Even international varieties are slowly being produced, such as Chardonnay and Tecava. And one of my favourite wines at the moment is a Gewürztraminer Tramina from Sonamontano in the foothills of the Pyrenees on the northeast side of Spain. Spain is a great place to experiment, so whilst they've been outdone by Chile, certainly there's some interesting wines and certainly worth discovering. And I haven't even mentioned Sherry at the moment. I'm a big fan of Pinot Sherry with some olives, yummy. And in our tastings, we've just started tasting a 20-year-old Sherry, and it is gorgeous. So lots of interesting wines from Spain, and definitely worth discovering. The only problem is, supermarkets usually only supply maybe a bit of Rioja Albarino if you're lucky, and Rioja. But there are some crackers around, and do have a look for them. Next up, we have the interview with Louis Latour about négociants. Hi, I'm here with Louis Fabrice Latour, owner of Louis Latour. How are you, Louis?
Very well, thank you. Very pleased to be here.
So we're going to be talking about négociants today. You guys are one of the more established négociants in Burgundy. Do you want to just tell me, give a quick overview of what your business is all about?
Oh, we've been around for 200 years as many négociants. We started as wine growers and we moved to the négociant activity in the middle of the 19th century. And since then, we've been one of the very active négociants. As you know, there are 60 to 70 of them in Burgundy. Yeah. So it's a good bunch of people.
What exactly is a négociant, though?
You know, as a joke, we are used to saying that a négociant éleveur, because we call it ourselves a négociant éleveur en vin fin de Bourgogne, is a successful wine grower. Which means that many of us are wine growers, and for Maison Latour, we are the biggest owner of Grand Cru. And we also have some other activities where we buy the must, the grapes, or we buy wines, and all the wine being bottled and sold under Maison Latour name.
So you buy in grapes as well as making your own wines, and you process it all the way through. Do you sell the wines directly to the public, or do you go through trade channels?
What we do is that we try to buy grapes and buy wine, but don't forget that what we want to achieve, and which is the very strong power about négociant, we choose some vintages that we like, we choose some villages that we like, we choose some wine growers what we like, and it does give us a lot of freedom. And by doing that, we make our wine the Maison Latour style, and we sell mostly to good restaurants, good retailers, and you were mentioning Majestic early on. We are selling a lot of wines to Majestic, and of course to some private customers. We don't sell to supermarkets.
So you said you get to choose the vintages as well as the producers and the villages, but négociants have a sort of a long-term relationship with growers, and therefore sometimes when the vintage isn't bad, you may still end up taking the wines. Is that true, or is that...
It's more complex than that. It's very true that in the whites, Chardonnay is good every year, so we have long-term contracts. When it comes to the reds, we sometimes say no to some wine growers, but if we don't take his Chassagne, we will give him a lift on his trade Bourgogne, and there is the Courtier in between. So we try to be fair and faithful to people, but I think the power of a négociant is to say no sometimes. And I think it's very important because our customers, they want good wines every year. And so we always find a solution, especially through the courtier, but sometimes we buy heavily, and we did buy heavily 05, for instance, and it's true that in the reds 04, we haven't bought that much.
So does that mean that your volumes that you've got available to your customers will vary possibly from year to year? And how do you smooth out that sort of lumpiness?
It does vary a lot. I wouldn't say in the regional appellations such as Bourgogne Rouge or Little Villages, but it does vary a lot at the Grand Cru level. It does vary a lot also in some villages from Côte de Nuit or Côte de Beaune, but mostly in the reds. In the whites, we do commit ourselves, and we make great Chardonnay every year.
Some producers, for example, in Bordeaux, they have multiple labels. They'll have their top label and then a second label, and the idea is that on a bad year, they might downgrade some top fruit into their second label to keep consistency, and in a good year they might be able to bump it up a wee bit. Do you guys play around with the appellation control? Obviously you can't upgrade lower quality grapes, but do you put Grand Cru into maybe Premier Cru wines?
We do the same, not to the extent of Bordeaux, but certainly in lesser vintages, we declassify. And for instance, our well-known Grand Cru is Corton Grancet, and we don't make Corton Grancet every year, and so it's declassified into Allos Corton, and there are some lesser vintages where Allos Corton goes into Côte de Beaune. So there are many négociants which are doing the same thing, which is to declassify. We haven't done it the way we used to in the 80s, but we've done it a bit in 04, Reds. I must admit. And it does happen sometimes, but less than in the past, because we've been very spoiled these last 15 years in Burgundy, and we had quite a few good vintages in a row.
So you've got your grapes from Burgundy, but I also notice you've got wines, you buy in grapes from all down through Rhône and even into Languedoc.
No, not exactly. We are deeply committed and deeply rooted now in Ardèche, and we do the Grand Ardèche and the Ardèche Chardonnay, which is well known here in the UK. We have our Pinot from the Var, but there we've built a winery, we have contract with wine growers. We are not there to do a coup. So we've been there in Ardèche for 30 years, in the Var for 15 years. But this is the only two places where we go south. We don't make any Coudron or Languedoc yet.
Some of the negotiants like Batten and Gastier, they get grapes from all over France. You guys have really stuck to the left-hand side, the right-hand side of France, really. You haven't really gone into Bordeaux or anything like that. What's the reason behind that?
I think what we know at Maison Latour, and we're not the only one to say that, we know two varietals, which are Pinot and Chardonnay. We don't pretend that we can vinify grapes everywhere. And may I say something which is important? I do believe that sometimes, and often it could happen, that our wines from Négociant are better than our wine growers' wines, the wine from our domain, because when you act as Négociant, you choose. Sometimes there are vineyards where we are deeply involved into the care of the vineyard throughout the year. We do the harvesting. And I think, for me, this distinction between domain and non-domain wine belongs to the past. It's an out-of-date distinction. And the question that you should wonder, and all your customers should wonder, is it a good wine or not? Because if you have a vineyard which is very well located, done by a very good wine grower, it can be sometimes better than a lesser located of your vineyard. So it's not because you own that you do a better job sometimes.
Interesting you bring up the concept of domain versus non-domain wines, because a lot of people do think that single estate wines are the top, but obviously in things like Burgundy, where the strips of land that people own, the ownership is so diverse, it must be quite hard for people to get economies of scale to be able to invest in equipment. Is that some of the reasoning driving behind some of the negotiants?
It can be that. It's more that sometimes when you vinify a bigger piece of land with more barrels, you are more able to do a good job. And I would say in terms of vinification, especially for the reds, but even for the whites, it does play a role. It's more, I would say, a question of location. Where are the wines located? And there are, don't forget that the Négociant, I know because I'm currently the president of the Négociant, but the Négociant are commercializing two-thirds of the Burgundy crop.
A lot of Burgundy's ownership used to be quite dispersed. I think the Napoleonic inheritance laws sort of caused a lot of splitting up of vineyards. That's recently been changing, hasn't it? Has there been some consolidation? I'd heard there'd been some consolidation. I presume that inheritance laws no longer apply.
No, we've seen some consolidation lately with vineyards going up in prices. There are a few wine growers who've sold, but it's still very, how you'd say that in English, there are still many small properties who will survive and do a very good job and make a very good living. No, Burgundy hasn't churned that much. And of course, there were a few mediatic stories, but it still remained the way it has been for many decades. The inheritance tax is bound to churn, we don't know, but it doesn't prevent people from giving that to children, and life can go on like that.
You touched on earlier about you've had 15 years of good vintages in a row, which is fairly good going. Do you think there's an influence maybe from global warming? I've seen graphs of picking dates, for example, in the Rheingau, and they're picking like 3 weeks ahead of where they were maybe 40, 50 years ago. You guys have got a big history. Have you seen picking dates change? And do you think that's going to affect your style of wine that you'll be able to produce?
No, it's a very relevant question, and we could spend hours on that matter. I would say that we've been very fortunate because global warming has played a big role. And certainly when I was younger, 20 years ago, we were used to harvesting early October. Now we are more keen on being around the 15th to the 20th of September. I do believe that this year we should be September 2nd or 3rd. But nevertheless, I would say that the biggest challenge of Burgundy today is not to make over-ripened wines. We should avoid to be within 14 degrees of alcohol. We should keep the acidity, and we shouldn't wait too long to harvest. And I think that 03 has been challenging for some of us, 06 also, because I think we've been too high in alcohol with low acidity. And I think Burgundy is about balance. And in order to achieve that balance, we should make sure that we keep a good alcoholic content, but we don't lose too much acidity. So I'm in favor more now to harvest in the middle of the crowd, because sometimes weather is too warm. So let's keep the acidity, and Burgundy identity is about acidity. Yeah. This is what makes us different from the New World wine, and it's something I do repeat to my friendly neighbors and competitors, either wine grower or négociant, all the time.
You're the president of the negotiations. What does that actually mean, Louis?
It means that during 6 years, you run the négociant association. It's very interesting. We discuss with the wine growers, we discuss with the BIVB, which is our interprofession. And also we discuss many big subjects about, you know, what we have with the French government, what we can do to make Burgundy getting out of the recession, how we can change the segmentation of wine, what should we do on chaptalisation. Nowadays we have a big subject about the way we give what we call the agreement of wine, or the way the wines can be authorized. And we discuss with the wine growers. There are many big subjects with the rules of OMC and the European rules. So it's very interesting.
One of the last things I just want to touch on is the Hospice du Bon. That's like your bellwether for setting prices. But Burgundy prices don't seem to ratchet up and down as much as maybe Bordeaux prices do. Do you want to just comment on how the prices are set in Burgundy, and maybe why prices don't seem to ramp up and down as much as other regions?
It's not an easy question, because normally the Hospice du Bon is a charity auction. But it's very true that I'm talking more on my behalf personally. I do believe myself, not all of us do believe that the Hospice du Bon is a reflection of what's going on at the grower level. And when you make a survey, 9 times out of 10, what has happened at the Hospice du Bon has been reflected into the prices at the wine grower level. Of course, the Hospice, because it's small quantities, overdo it, which means that if you go up at the Hospice by 30%, you will go up at the grower level by 10%. But it's always a reflection of what's going on at the grower level. Otherwise, the way the prices are made, it's very complex. Unless you live in Burgundy, you should live in Burgundy yourself. But it takes years. It's a combination of the négociant and the wine growers. And even the press forget that the courtier is playing a big role, and is going to see us, to see the wine growers as well. It's a market price. It's like a little stock exchange, keeping in mind that the quality of the product can vary. There are some wine growers to whom we take just his Puligny. Some of them we take his Puligny in Meuse. Some of them we will also take his Bourgogne Rouge. So it's a very, very complex thing. And people with whom we've been dealing with them for many, many decades sometimes. It's a very complex thing.
I always think Bordeaux prices perhaps reflect just as much about the world economy as perhaps the quality of the grapes or the harvest. Do you think that's true for Burgundy as well, or do you think you guys are more focused on the quality of the wine?
It's hard to say, but it's true that we are a bit like Bordeaux. A great vintage in the times of non-prosperity won't go very high. And if you remember 92, which was one of the greatest vintage in whites, it was one of the cheapest and one of the greatest quality-wise. Even 90 was a great vintage, but we were entering into the recession, so prices were very attractive. Of course, there is a linkage between quality and price, but not always. The worldwide situation, it's a bit like Bordeaux, will play a big role.
One last question, Louis. Given that some vintages are perceived as quite good bargains, what vintages that are starting to come good now, or that are drinking well now, should people be keeping an eye out for, do you think, that are possibly undervalued?
I think the best bet these days is to buy 04 whites. I think they, especially for the English palate, they are well balanced. The English like a good acidity, good minerality. They are the best ratio quality price you could find in the whites. When it comes to the reds, I think 3 or 5 are great vintages, but they are relatively expensive. I will perhaps try to rediscover some of the 01. It's not a big vintage, but it's showing very nicely now, not to keep, but for day-to-day drinking. And this is what we love about what we say in a very friendly way, what we love about the Brits, that they enjoy vintages which are ready to drink. And I'm very pleased to see that they don't hesitate to come back on 4 to 7, almost to 10 years old vintage and enjoy it. And they should keep it that way.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Louis. Thanks very much.
Merci.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Louis. I thought it was interesting that Louis considers Chardonnay to be a reliable producer, while Pinot Noir can be a bit of hit and miss. Never really thought about bad Pinot Noir from Burgundy, although I have had some spectacularly average Pinots in the past that have been quite expensive. I also like the idea of using a declassifying system to ensure that quality stays at the highest level. And I thought it was interesting that Louis considers acidity to be a key difference between his wines and the New World wines. It is true that wines lacking acidity do often taste a bit fatter in the mouth, but I like wines with a good, solid, acidic backbone. Acidity is a big structural element of wine and should be embraced, even if the wines don't have the same weight in the mouth that a fat, ripe, hot climate wine will have. One thing that Louis didn't say that a lot of French people say is elegance. It's a terrible word, but I've concluded after listening to many people talk about these elegant wines, all they're really talking about as acidic or crisp. You ever look at a wine that's described as elegant, it's always got a lot of acidity to it. If you take elegant to its natural conclusion, then Louis Latour tries to make an elegant wine. Next week, for something a wee bit different, we're going to be talking with Warren Edwards from Wine for Spice. Wine for Spice make a slightly fizzy wine that they reckon goes down with Indian food and spicy food as well. So we find out about how to match spicy food with wines. A hard match to make. And personally, if I'm going to drink a Vindaloo, I do tend to go for a Cobra beer. But we'll find out about matching spicy wines with food. So, until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.